Are predictions of the coming apocalypse being used to control all of us? In a moment, John Michael Greer comes back to Coast as we talk about his latest work, Apocalypse Not. Everything you know about 2012, Nostradamus and the Rapture is wrong. Get ready for that on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. John Michael Greer, noted author in the fields of alternative spirituality and future studies, including the award-winning The New Encyclopedia of the Occult, The Long Descent, A User's Guide to the End of the Industry Age, and Secrets of the Lost Symbol. He is also the author of a very popular weekly blog on the future. It's called The Archdruid Report. And here he is back on Coast to Coast. John Michael, how are you?
Doing very well. Glad to be back.
Oh, my pleasure, too. The time flies by. Huh? It's well over 2 years. My gosh.
Yeah.
Almost three.
Almost 3 years? Wow. It doesn't seem like anything like that long.
No, it's going fast. You know what? I love the study that you've done here with this book and what you've come up with, because I have long since believed that, you know, scaring people about the apocalypse, end of time, it's all over, was a great way to keep your thumb on people. And I think you found that.
Very much so.
Let's talk a bit about why past histories have always thought they were in end times. How come, John Michael?
Well, it's an interesting question, because the gimmick seems to have been invented at a specific time by a specific person. As far as anyone's been able to find out, the whole apocalypse thing dates back to Zarathustra, the founder of the Zoroastrian religion, around 1300 BC. As far as anyone has been able to tell, there was no apocalyptic stuff before his time, and you can trace every single set of apocalyptic fantasies, predictions, and prophecies back through time to that one source.
How about the Book of Revelation? Does that add to this feeling of doom and gloom?
Oh, very much so. That's really the classic apocalyptic story in the Western world. It's the one that everybody has basically been modeling off of in the parts of the world that have historically been Christian. I mean, it's technicolor. I mean, you've got beasts, you've got a woman clothed with the sun, you've got monsters with tails of scorpions, you've got, you know, plagues and death, and you name
yeah.
it. It's really colorful.
Things coming from the sky, it's got it all.
It really does.
These end-of-the-world predictions, do they generally come from, you know, the tribal chiefs? Who creates them?
Almost anybody. We saw an example with Harold Camping earlier.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, you saw that one. But that's the kind of thing. Once people get caught up in the whole apocalypse shtick, you know, it doesn't matter who. It could be anybody.
Did you think that Camping actually believed this himself? What do you think?
I think he did. I mean, how can you tell? I never had a chance to actually meet the guy and sit down with him.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of people do. They've bought into the meme. They've bought into this idea that that not only is the world going to end, but they know the date. And they build their lives around it. And then, of course, they're left just kind of hanging there when nothing happens, as is always what happens.
Well, we saw Jonestown, Heaven's Gate, these people that think, you know, they're going to that other side, and they follow it. You know, in Camping's case, May 21st, it came, it went, nothing happened. Mm-hmm. Some people emptied their bank accounts, their 401ks, and everything else. And then he sets the date October 21st. And you know what? Yeah, if there was a rapture, I don't know anybody who was taken.
Well, I've sometimes thought that if the rapture actually does happen, the 6 or 7 real Christians in the world will, in fact, be beamed to heaven, leaving the rest of us here.
Stuck here. Let's talk a little bit more about the origins of the apocalypse belief and the end of the world predictions here. Do you think governments, you know, concocted some of this and they said, you know, let's create this so we can scare our people and we'll control them?
Well, I think to some extent it's governments. Some governments have certainly done so. I mean, the entire communist movement, for example, was very much an apocalyptic kind of thing. You know, someday our descendants will live under communism, the glorious capitalist, you know, glorious communist revolution or what have you. And it was all very much this whipped up frenzy of, you know, we are the vanguard of history marching off into what? Another prison camp, basically. And that's been done before. But you also get people who are ambitious, people who want power, who want to manipulate others, but maybe don't have it yet. And for people like that, the apocalypse thing is just, you know, practically heaven sent for them. They can convince people that, you know, they are the leader who will lead people into the glorious paradise, what have you. And people will fall for it again and again and again.
One of the latest ones, of course, the December 21st, 2012 Mayan calendar day, where a number of people come up with all kinds of theories, you know, a moment of enlightenment. I throw in, I think it's going to be some kind of solar event from the sun, not an end times event at all. But other people, Michael, think, you know, it's all over. It's done. We're going to die on that day. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Well, let's start with a crucial point here. The ancient Mayans actually didn't predict that anything particular was going to happen on that date. It's just one of many, many dates, many rollovers in the very complicated Mayan calendar, which has all kinds of cycles. One of them finishes on that date, but, you know, there are others, and there are dates in the Mayan writings and in inscriptions on temples and so on that go anything up to millions of years in the future. So the Mayans didn't actually think that at all. The Mayans were not waiting for the apocalypse then. It, unfortunately, it's one of those things that got started within the American alternative spiritual community with Terence McKenna and then Jose Arguelles latching onto this date and becoming convinced that, well, we're not sure what, but something big is going to happen that date. And then, of course, once it became kind of a popular date, you have all of these predictions, whether, as you said, it's, you know, a solar flare, whether it's instantaneous enlightenment, the return of the Space Brothers, the return of Quetzalcoatl, you know, collision between Earth and a meteor. Fill in the blank. Everybody thinks they know what's going to happen, but the only reason that date seems to be grabbing people is that it's the popular one.
Do you think that most people like to get scared?
Oh, yeah. Why do you think horror fiction does so well? Everyone likes a zombie movie or a Stephen King novel or something.
Why is that? What does that tell you about the human psyche?
I wish I understood. I don't like horror fiction. I don't like scary movies, but apparently a lot of people do. And, I think I see where you're leading here, and you're quite right that, you know, the apocalypse is the ultimate horror movie.
It's
not just, you know, it's not just, you know, the characters in the movie that get ripped apart by the mad slasher or what have you. It's the whole planet. We love to be scared, apparently.
Well, we do. So when you wrote Apocalypse Not, did you come in conflict with anything that you saw that past civilizations had been doing?
Well,
did you tear down any barriers?
Mostly the thing that I noticed was that we tend in modern times to think of ourselves as smarter than our ancestors. I mean, we've got all these technological toys that they didn't have, all this kind of stuff. But I looked at the way we're responding to some of the things in our own time. And I looked at the way that the ancient Romans responded in their time and so on back through history. And, you know, if we're smarter than them, it certainly doesn't show. So I'm, you know, in terms of how we think about ourselves, our place in the universe and so on, they thought they were the most special people on Earth. We think the same thing. And so the one barrier that I think I had to really kick through was this notion that we're special, that we're brighter, that we're, you know, the generation that gets whatever it is the generation is going to get.
I get a kick out of the person who walks up and down a street holding a sign saying, "Repent, the end is near." I actually think he believes that.
I mean, many of them do.
Yeah.
And the fact that he's going to spend the rest of his life walking up and down that street.
That's true. And you know what could happen, though? A piano will fall out of a building and kill him.
Well, his end.
Something.
Sooner or later, his end is going to come.
That's true.
I mean, he could just fall over from old age.
Yep. That is absolutely true. What do governments do with this, John?
Well, it depends on the government. They vary. Because some of them encourage, again, like the communist governments, some of them encourage this kind of apocalyptic thing. Some of them are very much in opposition to it. The People's Republic of China, for example, the Chinese have been, in China, for thousands of years, the standard way to start a political revolution is to proclaim, you know, the coming of the apocalypse. That's been going on since, like, the 2nd century B.C.
Hmm.
And so they had Zoroastrian missionaries way early, and so they got that idea from that came from Zarathustra originally. But yeah, you proclaim that the mandate of heaven has passed from whoever is the current emperor to you, and then lead a revolution and you take over, if you're lucky. Otherwise, you get like chopped into small pieces an inch at a time, which is just the consequences for failure in Chinese bare knuckle politics. But the reason why, for example, the Chinese cracked down so hard on the whole Falun Dafa movement is they are very nervous about that. They're aware that these potentially millenarian religious groups can turn into political movements at the drop of a hat, and so in within communist China, you don't talk apocalypse, or you can discuss the matter with your fellow inmates at a prison camp for a very long time.
You've written books about UFOs. Is it possible that governments don't disclose, assuming you believe in this, it's possible that governments don't disclose because they're afraid of that same thing, losing control?
Whatever is behind the UFO phenomenon, we don't need to get into that now. That's a swamp in and of itself.
Yeah.
Certainly governments are keeping a lid on whatever they know about it. And certainly governments have been very hard-pressed to downplay the idea that there might be, actual contact with alien beings, because, that would cause exactly the kind of, the apocalyptic situation. And whether or not there are actually aliens involved in it, that's the kind of thing that could allow demagogues to whip up a following, It could be a mess. There have been some speculations that at various points over the last few decades, the various people were trying to use either real or faked UFO phenomena as a springboard to political power. Jacques Vallée talked about that in, yes, which was his Messengers of Deception. Very interesting UFO book back in the 70s. I'm sure you read it.
Absolutely. Yep, sure did. Uh-huh. Are past prophets, have they been accurate with anything?
Well, actually, that's one of the funny things, because in some cases they have. And a couple of the most famous here, Jesus of Nazareth comes to mind. We're heading up on his birthday, might as well bring him up. Mm-hmm. According to the Gospels, he when he was visiting the temple in Jerusalem, I think it was not that long before he was crucified, he said, look, you need to understand something. Within the lifetime of some of you here, that temple is going to be torn flat to the ground, not one stone standing on another. Most of the people in Judea, you're going to have to flee to the hills or you'll be annihilated, so on and so forth. Everyone's taken that as though it's talking about an end of the world. But of course, if you realize he was talking about the Roman-Jewish war that broke out in 66 AD, he was absolutely right.
Well, he sure was.
And making that call almost 40 years in advance, that's impressive.
What about Nostradamus?
Nostradamus, not so much. Nostradamus is difficult because you can hardly ever tell what he's talking about. But the few times that he does give an exact date, there are some problems. I mean, do you remember
in 1999,
people were getting really upset about the Y2K non-crisis, but there was also a Nostradamus quatrain that goes, 1999, 8th month, the great king of terror descends from the heavens, and so on and so forth. Did you see it?
No. What if he was off, though?
Oh, maybe he was off. But in that case, off which direction?
True. Some say maybe he meant 9/11.
Maybe he did mean, but he doesn't say much. It doesn't actually. I mean, by that same argument, you could say that it actually was the Tunguska meteorite in, what was it, 1907?
Something like that.
Something like that. Yeah. Or maybe it was 1999 BC.
What about a prophet like Edgar Casey?
Casey is an interesting cat because one of the things, there was actually a really interesting study of his stuff a while ago where some researcher had gone through all of his trance readings and noted the ones that dealt with health and the ones that dealt with the past and the ones that dealt with the future.
The health ones were pretty darn accurate.
The health ones were remarkable. Very often his treatments brought at least some relief and very often cures.
That's right.
To very severe situations. But the past and the future ones, they weren't literally true. Symbolically, but not literally. For the very famous one that he predicted that Atlantis would rise above the waves in, was it 1968, I think it was. Now, literally speaking, that didn't happen.
Right.
But in 1968, there was the discovery of the Bimini Road. In 1968, there was the vast upsurge of, you know, Atlantean speculation and ideas from the occult tradition and things like that. I don't happen to remember if that's when Donovan did his song about Atlantis, but it was right around then. So in a kind of symbolic sense, Atlantis did in fact rise above the waves at that point, above the waves of our consciousness.
You know, he's predicted the future of North America to be devastating in terms of a map and its outlook. I mean, flooding, California gone, everything else.
Uh-huh.
I mean, what if he's right?
Well, if, in that case, if you live in California, I'd say make sure you have some water wings, Andy.
That's right. Move in. Move in fast. But, I mean, his accuracy, you would say, is what? Good on health, bad on the other
good
stuff?
Good on health, good symbolically on the other stuff. Again, you read it like you'd read a dream. You know, you sit down with a psychologist and you describe this dream, and the psychologist will help you walk you through it and explain that it's symbols. And if you understand the symbols, you understand what it's trying to say to you. I really think that a lot of what Casey was picking up was symbolic. And if you know how to read it, then it can take you to some interesting places.
John Michael, what if, I'm going to take a devil's advocate position for a moment. That doesn't mean I believe it by any means. But what if there is no God? There is no rapture. There is no end times. There is nothing. There's no prophecy. There's no life after death. You know, your soul doesn't exist. What if all those things that we have believed over the years is a bunch of nonsense? Where does that fit into your writing, Apocalypse Not?
Well, basically, whether or not that's the case, we'll never know. Okay. If that is actually true, none of us will ever know it, because the rapture won't happen, the second coming won't happen, but people will still keep waiting for them.
We'll die and we'll never know.
We'll die and we'll never know. You know, we die dead. But the thing is, Apocalypse Not is not trying to make that argument. It is trying to make the argument that when people get themselves completely bent out of shape, convinced that they know that the world's going to end next Thursday, they're facing a world of disappointment consistently, every single time.
But will someone someday be right about a date?
Good question. The thing is also, the apocalypse is not just, you know, something bad happens. Okay, I mean, bad things happen, right? And eventually, you know, our species is going to die out. Eventually, the Earth is going to, you know, become lifeless and ultimately get blown back into cosmic dust. But the thing about the apocalypse myth, if you follow it, what really gives it its kick is what happens afterwards. Because there's almost always an afterwards. And what happens afterwards is usually somebody's fondest daydream, whether it's, you know, we're going to be raptured to heaven and then watch everybody who's ever made fun of us get the crap stomped out of them. Or whether it's the space brothers are going to land and, you know, give us infinite free energy and you know, like spaceship rides. Or whether it's like the survivalists who really want to be blazing away a full auto on hordes of advancing zombies. It's always the daydream. And so, you know, will the world end eventually? Doubtless. But will there be the kind of apocalyptic thing where everybody but you gets wiped out and then you get whatever you most wanted? Probably not.
That's interesting. Historically, go ahead.
No, and you see, that's the thing that I think so often gets used by ambitious people to control other people by luring them with the apocalypse thing. It's not just the fear. It's the craving. It's the fantasy of having what you've always wanted.
Now, let me do a reverse.
Go ahead.
Let's assume all that I just mentioned is real. There is a God. There is life after death. All these things are out there.
Mm-hmm.
And that eventually the book of Revelation is accurate and that it could happen one day. So is your argument primarily, it's not a matter of when or if, it's a matter of right now, it's not the case?
Well, it's the matter of having a certain amount of skepticism about any individual claim.
Let's talk about singularity and that again when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, I hope you're getting ready for Thanksgiving. Lots of folks are up right now cooking away, just getting ready. I'm going to wait a few hours. I'll do it when I wake up. I'll be back in a moment. John Michael Greer, we're talking about his work, Apocalypse Not. And we'll get rolling here on Coast to Coast AM. John Michael Greer, where does singularity fit into all this?
Oh, man, that's one of those ones that, what can you say? The singularity, I mean, the original version of it, the Ray Kurzweil version of it, there are many different accounts of the basic idea, though, is that at some point in the future, computers are actually going to become intelligent, fully intelligent, conscious beings, and then more intelligent than we are. And the theory is that eventually they'll become so intelligent that we can't predict what they will do. Now, will that happen? Heck of a good question. Not that long ago, people were saying that we'd have fusion power by now. You know, you can't always predict how fast technological advances are going to go. But in terms of the sort of Ray Kurzweil version of the singularity, you've got this idea that, you know, these super intelligent computers will design even more intelligent computers and ultimately computers that are basically godlike. And then those computers will solve all the world's problems and help us, show us how to upload our consciousness into immortal robot bodies and we'll go zooming away into outer space. It's the rapture. It's precisely the same thing that the fundamentalist Christians are talking about when they talk about with the rapture, except you've got supercomputers in place of Jesus, you've got robot bodies in case of the glorified bodies of the saved, you've got outer space in place of heaven, right down the line.
Might it be the sign of the beast?
Presumably, or it could just be that Ray Kurzweil and Reverend Camper have been smoking the same set of ideas.
Well, that could be, too. Where does the Antichrist fit into all this?
Because the Antichrist, that's a fascinating one because, you know, they've been writing biographies of this guy since about the 6th century or thereabouts.
Sure. And he's part of prophecy, isn't he?
Well, he's mentioned a couple of times in the book of Revelations, for example. But, of course, all that, there's just a couple of references. And on that basis, you get these huge biographical accounts giving every single detail of his life from his birth all the way up to his annihilation by the forces of Christ, which is interesting since none of it has happened yet. Now, of course, hunting the Antichrist has been a major sport. It's been open season for the last 2,000 years. And every few years, there's somebody new. Do you remember when Saddam Hussein was the Antichrist?
Yes.
And then there was, Anwar Sadat was the Antichrist.
Osama bin Laden.
Gorbachev was the Antichrist. Between the two world wars, Mussolini was everybody's favorite target. A lot of people insisted Mussolini had to be the Antichrist. Adolf Hitler was just kind of a lackey of his. Somehow it didn't work out that way.
Maybe they're all the Antichrist.
They're all the Antichrist. Yeah, it's kind of an Antichrist of the Month club.
So your conclusion basically is what with Apocalypse Not?
With Apocalypse Not, basically that there is this particular set of ideas, and I call it based on the meme theory of Richard Dawkins, the idea that there are these ideas that can replicate themselves through society the way a gene replicates itself through a biological community. The Apocalypse belief is a meme. It's a self-replicating set of ideas that makes people believe something that pretty consistently doesn't happen.
Do you think governments are behind this?
Well, I think they benefit from it.
They encourage it?
Some do. Some are terrified of it. But the thing about the apocalypse is that if you're waiting for the world to end, you're probably not going to be taking that much time and energy to ask hard questions about, say, what's happening to your tax dollars,
mm-hmm.
or what the government is doing in your name,
or wars, or
yeah, exactly.
Like
you know,
that.
Well, it's all in prophecy. Well, of course we have to go to war because it says in prophecy that there will be wars and rumors of wars. Well, you know, maybe so, but maybe that's going to happen a long time from now, or maybe the Book of Revelation has actually already happened. And we just misunderstood it. And it does make a very convenient cover for people who are trying to, people in government, people out of government, who have an eye toward power and want people who don't think too much.
Yet you will admit that some people are intuitive, some people are psychic, right?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
Well, by doing so,
mm-hmm.
Don't you think some of their predictions of end of the world might be true?
Well, the thing that I've noticed is that the people that I've met who are actually really intuitive, really perceptive, the kind of people you sit down for a reading for, and, you know, they make your skin crawl, they're that accurate, they're not the ones who are out there saying the world is going to end. By and large.
Most of them will just tell you as an individual, you know, what things might be like for you.
Exactly. They'll talk you or they'll talk you through the problems that you haven't yet talked to them about, and things like that. They're very perceptive, but maybe it's just me. Maybe I just haven't met the right psychics or something. But the people that I know, who I thought were really on the ball with that in that kind of thing, are not the ones who are out there with Harold Camping saying the world's going to end on X date.
Could you say this about just about everything? And let me explain by that.
Go ahead.
I do not believe in peak oil. I think this planet has an abundance of it. I think it's abiotic. I think it was with the planet as it was formed. Nonetheless, there's a camp out there that believes that we have a finite end to oil. They call it peak oil.
Mm-hmm.
What if that's just a scare tactic to keep prices up?
Well, the problem now there, of course, we're on opposite sides of a very interesting question. I've written several books on peak oil. Whatever the source of oil may be, the people who have the most to gain by trying to keep oil up, the price of oil up, are the people who are denouncing peak oil most firmly. I mean, the oil companies. Exxon has a lot to gain. If the price of oil goes through the roof, they get how much money? They've been making plenty of money recently. They're also out there insisting.
They're always making money.
Yeah, but they make more money when the price goes up.
Of course.
But they're the ones who are saying peak oil is a myth.
But they know when to pull back, and they know when to push.
Yeah.
I think they have a feeling of the breaking point of people, and they'll take you to the edge. Mm-hmm. And right before you think they're going to push you off, they pull you back again, and you feel relieved. So though you may have been paying $3.50 a gallon, and then it went up to $4.50, they'll bring it back down to $4. And you think, oh, my gosh, they're saving us. And then I don't know.
I haven't heard many people say that about Exxon.
And then they push you a little further. They're conditioning you.
Well, maybe so. But it actually, you know, when I look at what's been happening with the price of oil and also with world oil production, it looks to me more as though the peak oil thesis explains it better than the oil company conspiracy thesis. Still, you know, we'll see what happens.
I mean, in theory, if peak oil was correct, and it's not a moment of peak oil here with you, but I'm curious, when do you think, because they say we should have peaked out years ago, right?
Well, that depends. The peak in conventional petroleum production happened in 2005. We've been on a plateau since 2004. We've been stuck on a plateau despite prices quadrupling. Okay.
But most peak oil people, believers, say that we're on a downward spiral of total oil left on the planet.
Well, yeah. I mean, we've all seen a picture of oil. We've all seen a picture of the Earth from space. I'm sure nobody saw a pipeline coming in from Neptune to refill whatever we've got. So,
not to say that we should be using these fuels.
But the point is, you know, however much oil is in the world, there's only so much of it. There's not an infinite amount. You can't fit an infinite amount of oil in a finite planet.
No, even if it was
even
part
if
of
it's
the
abiotic,
planet.
Even if the whole planet is like filled with a chewing nougat center of oil. There's only so much of it.
Eventually you run out.
And the question is simply when.
When, exactly. Yeah. Will it be our lifetime, our kids' lifetime? Who knows?
And so that's really the point at issue. Now, you're right that there are people in the peak oil scene who have turned that into an apocalypse.
Yes.
You know, who have pushed it to October 21st, the oil's going to run out and we're all going to die. But, you know, I was, in fact, a little over 2 weeks ago, I was at the big national meeting of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil, ASPO, in Washington, D.C., and there were a lot of people, there were a lot of petroleum engineers, a lot of investment types, all people who were looking at how to position themselves to deal with this sort of thing, and there were very few people who were doing the kind of blazing away at zombies attitude toward the future. Most people were very sensibly looking, okay, in a world of where there's some degree of energy shortage, what's that going to do? What's that going to take? What are we going to have to do to prepare for that? and what are the consequences going to be in terms of politics, economic society, and so on. It was very straightforward.
John, do you find that different religions, different societies look at apocalyptic predictions in different ways?
Oh, yeah. Oh, man, yeah. There are religious traditions that don't have anything apocalyptic in them at all. At all. Not a trace of it.
That's interesting. So they're enlightened, right?
Well, or some of them are just, you know, the idea is that the world was, I'm thinking Shinto, which is the kind of traditional religion of Japan, which I got some exposure to growing up with a Japanese stepmother. In Shinto, the world was created by the gods, the kami, and it will continue, you know, basically forever because the kami made it and that's the way they want it. It's very straightforward. You get other religions like Hinduism where the world goes through cycles. There isn't a beginning and end. It's this big rollover process. And there are parts of the cycle that are pretty grim and there are parts of the cycle that are pretty wonderful. But you just hang on to the wheel because it's going to take you. Keep on taking you around.
Well, Christianity is apocalyptic. What about the Jewish faith?
Yeah, the Jewish faith absorbed a very strong apocalyptic element quite early on. And so you've got this idea that eventually the Messiah will come and then, you know, and call all the Jews together and then restore the temple and various wonderful things will happen. And they've been waiting for that for quite a while now.
Muslims, what about them?
Excuse me?
Muslims.
Oh, they're very apocalyptic. They have got, they've got a fairly similar version of the whole thing that to the one the Christians have. The Antichrist, their Antichrist is called the Dajjal, and he's just as nasty as the Antichrist is. And the Mahdi, who is the final prophet, the figure who will come at the end of time to lead all the good Muslims into paradise. You know, he will show up, and the Muslims believe that Jesus will show up along with him. They believe is one of their prophets. And so there's this, yeah, they've got this very colorful apocalyptic myth, and they're very focused on it.
Is the concept of the devil, you're going to die, you're going to go to hell, is that also created? Is that part of this whole myth?
That's a complicated one. The same guy who seems to have invented the apocalypse meme, Zarathustra, is also apparently the first guy to come up with the idea that the entire universe is divided straight down the middle into a war between the powers of good and the powers of evil. I mean, you've got a lot of the old pagan faiths where there are gods you want to hang with and there are gods you do not want to hang with. And there are, you know, or there are like frost giants. I'm thinking the Norse religion these days where you have the gods who are basically defending the world against these vast cosmic powers of chaos. But the idea of a devil, you know, a single, malign, nasty, you know, being who is absolutely evil through and through and exists solely for the purpose of making your life as miserable as possible. Okay, that seems to have been Zarathustra's idea. His was Ahriman, the spirit of the lie, and against whom was Ormuzd, the lord of light, and all this kind of stuff. And so you go from there. You get that sort of that notion coming into Christianity, coming into Islam, coming into some other religions. And so it's very much part of the thing nowadays, that part of the whole apocalyptic thing, that the apocalypse is the final inning of the great baseball game of the cosmos, where, you know, the devil finally gets struck out and God takes the title.
Who would be more apt to believe in some kind of an apocalypse? Somebody who's wealthy, somebody who's more educated, who would believe?
Well, it's really a mixed bag. And it seems to depend much less on issues like income and education than a combination of personal and social stress. The more stressed out a society becomes, the more people turn to the apocalyptic as, you know, if nothing else, seeking a kind of sense of relief. And that's also true in your individual life. There was a conversation I had some years ago with David Spangler, who's a spiritual teacher of quite some years standing, right in the run-up to the Y2K business. Okay, mm-hmm. He ended up in this conversation with this woman that he'd met, who was saying that she was really, really worried about the Y2K thing. And, you know, she's going, okay, I can understand this. You know, banks shutting down, computers crashing. No. She put him straight. That wasn't what she was worried about. Her marriage was on the rocks. Her job was in a dead end. Her life was stuck in a rut. And the thing that terrified her more than anything else was having to wake up on January 1st, 2000 and go on with her life.
Ah.
Now, I don't know. It seems to me that, you know, dealing with an unsatisfactory life is less traumatic than, say, dying in a burned-out basement. But for some reason, this the dream of apocalypse is very appealing to a lot of people who, you know,
it's escapism for it,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it's escapism. You know, the rapture is the perfect escapist fantasy. I mean, on the one hand, it's, you know, you get beamed up like you know, Star Trek, but you know, it's also basically a suicide fantasy. You know, when somebody says, "Grandma's gone to be with Jesus," most people know what that means. And it's really rather scary that we've got millions of Americans who have basically put all of their hopes to the future in this kind of suicide fantasy. The world's going to get really bad, and then we're going to go to be with Jesus.
Did you come across any pitfalls during the research for the book? Anything particularly horrifying or anything like that?
Well, the thing that, I don't know, the story that really horrified me more than anything else was the one about the Heaven's Gate thing. Because yeah, that had been building for a long time. You can read books from the UFO literature from the 1970s, where they're talking about Marshall Applewhite, he and his, I forget the name of the woman who was his co-prophet in that, but they went by Bo and Peep, respectively. And they went through various other names, but you know, people were saying back in the 70s, oh, man, this is not going to end well. Jacques Vallée talks about him. I think it's, in Messengers of Deception. Mm-hmm. And this whole thing just kind of spiraled in on itself bit by bit until eventually you had all of these, some of them very gifted people, very creative people, who could see no way forward but to, you know, swallow a bunch of poison. So
that, yeah. But what does that tell you, John, about people?
Well, you know, some people can box themselves into a corner where there is no way out. And people do that in various ways.
Didn't they have like $5 in quarters with each one?
Yeah,
they had new tennis shoes.
Yeah, they all had new tennis shoes. They all had a certain amount of change. And for some reason, apparently the aliens want exact change or something. But it was this really complex, ritualized, formalized thing. And, you know...
It's bizarre.
It's bizarre. It's really sad that people who could have done probably a great deal of good in the world instead got sucked into this fantasy that, you know, they were going to beam up onto a spaceship that was hiding in the shadow of Comet Hale-Bopp, I think it was.
Yep.
And away we go. Well, away they went, but probably not the way they had in mind.
Unbelievable. And what was one of the funniest moments?
The funniest. There's a lot of funny stories in the world of apocalypse, but the funniest one is a guy named Charles Fourier, who was a French intellectual, philosopher, mystic, visionary, right after the Napoleonic Wars. And now this was actually fairly popular at the time. You had all of these intellectuals who were convinced that they were the turning point of history. Mm-hmm. Their ideas were, you know, the arrival of their ideas on Earth marked the greatest moment in human history. And Fourier was this kind of guy. He had worked out this exceptionally complex theory of you know, how to bring about a utopia, you know, this perfect society on Earth where everything would be driven by passional attraction and people would spend all of their time engaged in gourmet dining and plenty of sex and things like this. But he believed that when enough people accepted his ideas, these clouds of cosmic citric acid, I'm not making this up, cosmic citric acid would descend from the skies, turn the seas into lemonade.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. All the lions on Earth would suddenly instantly turn into cuddlesome vegetarian anti-lions. And so on. And so on. It's wild stuff. Understandably, it became popular for a while again back during the 60s. I think you have a certain amount of LSD or THC level in your blood, and Fourier starts making a certain amount of sense.
Strange. John, hold on. We're going to come back. We're going to take this break and roll right along on Coast to Coast AM.